Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 10, the second lecture of a four-lecture set entitled The Growth of Opera, The Development of Italian Opera Seria, and Mozart's Idomeneo. At the end of the last lecture, I promised you a kind of point-counterpoint, two different points of view regarding this first phase of the so-called golden dark age of opera, that is, two different, estimates of the quality and nature of this opera written essentially in or out of Venice between 1640 and 1700. So here are these two counter evaluations. And first, the good news, the upside, the golden age stuff. And I will allow Donald Grout to tell us his positive opinion, his good spin on this opera. The Venetian opera of this period was scenically and musically splendid. Admittedly, the plots were a jumble of improbable characters and situations, a sometimes irrational mixture of serious and comic scenes, and served mainly as pretexts for pleasant melodies, beautiful solo singing, and striking stage effects, such as clouds bearing a large number of persons, enchanted gardens, and other such transformations. Vocal virtuosity had not yet reached the heights it attained in the 18th century. The orchestra had little to do except accompany the singers, and the recitatives were of only slight musical interest. Indeed, the aria reigned supreme, and its victory, in one sense, marked the victory of popular taste over the aristocratic refinement of the original Florentine recitative, which had been so intimately connected with the rhythms and moods of the text. But again, Grout says, the Venetian opera of this period was scenically and musically splendid. Okay, the upside. Now, the downside, the bad news. Joseph Kerman is rather more unkind in his critical summary of Venetian opera. 17th century Venetian opera had thrown dignity into the canals and was busy encrusting Latin history with a scandalous, picaresque confusion of plot. It had completely debased recitative in favor of rather primitive arias and had completely eliminated the chorus. It was the worst period in Italian opera history, unquote. You know, you'll excuse me, this reminds me of a joke. It's an old joke. It's not a great joke, but it's completely applicable, so I will tell it. It's the one about that platoon of soldiers trapped on a farm far behind enemy lines. The sergeant gets up and says, "Men, I've got good news and bad news. What do you want first?" "Tell us the bad news, Sarge." So the sergeant begins, "All right, we're trapped far behind enemy lines on this farm. We could be here for weeks. We could be here for months. Who knows? It's dangerous. Every day could be the end. It could mean discovery and prison, if not being shot. And all we've got to eat for the time we're here is cow dung." So the soldiers look at each other and say, "Oh, boy." So finally, one of them says, "Well, what's the good news?" And the sergeant says, "There's lots of it." Now, what does this have to do with 17th century Venetian opera? Well, here we have opera based on fatuous, ridiculous stories with unreal characters, an amazing amount of stupid machinery and scenes which might have nothing to do with the drama whatsoever. Basically, song and dance and dog acts parading as opera. What's the good news? There's lots of it. All right, please, let's continue. We'll talk about 17th century French opera during a later lecture, but it's necessary for us to continue now in the mainstream, which means Italian opera, and it's now necessary to talk about that second phase of Baroque opera, the second phase of the golden slash dark age of opera, that is phase two, from about 1700 to 1760. And in talking about this opera, we will talk about the creation of Italian opera seria. By the end of the 17th century and the beginning of the 18th century, literary devotees of opera were determined to reform the medium and return to it at least some degree of literary substance to what had become, of course, a bastardized medium dominated by music and singers, the stories having become fatuous and almost incidental to what happens on stage. Now, chief among these literary reformers were the poets Carlo Goldoni, who lived from 1707 to 1793, Apostolo Zeno, Z-E-N-O, who lived from 1668 to 1750, and most importantly, Pietro Metastasio, who lived from 1698 to 1782. This operatic reformation was brought to fulfillment by Pietro Metastasio, the guiding genius of 18th century Italian opera and a literary figure of such stature that I would tell you that his compatriots seriously compared him with Homer and Dante. Metastasio's 27 Drammi per Musica, that is, dramas for music, and other theater works were given, and get this, they were given over 1,000 different musical settings during the 18th century. Some of Metastasio's libretti were set to music as many as 70 times. Now, we have no equivalent in our modern world today. This is as if 70 different composers set to music Stephen Sondheim's lyrics to West Side Story. Each time, different music, different composer. Now, this is only understandable when we keep in mind that in a pre-electronic age, in which there was little or no sense of repertoire, you could only hear opera live, and most likely the operas you heard would have been composed specifically for that season, in that city, at that opera house. So recycling good libretti was the rule rather than the exception, and ultimately it was a good idea, because a good libretto was hard to come by, and if no one had heard it in the city, why not use it? Now, according to Donald Grout, a modern reader is apt to find Metastasio's plays mannered and artificial, so Dante or Homer he is not. Elegant rather than powerful, his characters seem more like 18th century courtiers than ancient Romans. Sentimental quandaries made up most of his situations, and amorous and political intrigue followed. There is almost always a lieto fine, a happy ending. And the stock figure of the magnanimous tyrant is typically in evidence. Yet, in spite of all of this, if one is willing to allow for the dramatic conventions of the time, some of Metastasio's plays might still be read with pleasure. His achievement, and this is the important thing, my friends, his achievement consisted in the creation of a consistent dramatic structure conforming to the rationalistic ideals of the period, but incorporating lyric elements suited well for musical setting in such a way as to create an organized, organic literary whole. That means something with literary integrity, that is, a formula for creating a coherent operatic storyline. So what Metastasio basically did was create a formula, was to standardize his libretti into a veritable formulaic procedure. And I will let the wonderful opera scholar William Mann describe this process, this procedure. And again, as I read this description, I want you to contemplate, as I'm asking you to do much in the previous lecture and in this lecture, compare this to what in our culture today this is equivalent to. We have lots of stock literary procedures. We have the half-hour sitcom, which inevitably follows a certain formula. We have the one-hour cop or detective show. We have the one-hour hospital drama, the typical emergency room thing, whether it's, you know, Dr. Kildare, all the way through to whatever emergency thing is on the tube right now. We've got all kinds of literary genres that are predictable and formulaic. Indeed, they break the formula here and there, and that's what makes that particular episode interesting. But we have an expectation. We have a formula, and the writers work within that expectation. So we have equivalents in our own culture to what I'm about to point out. The various characters would enter one by one and converse in dry recitative. That means very simply accompanied recitative, accompanied typically by a harpsichord and maybe a cello playing the bass notes, during which some trait of character or dramatic incident would be revealed. After the event had occurred, whatever it was, the most involved person would sing an aria which summed up the situation and then would leave the stage. The aria, which had been carefully designed to exhibit the singer's best vocal qualities, might be one of several kinds: charming, angry, imperious, rapid patter, brilliant, smoothly wheedling, or some no man's land in between all of these. the principal characters had to sing one or two arias in each act, the subsidiary persons one or two in the course of the three-act opera, and it was always a three-act opera. No two successive arias could use the same singer, the same mood, or the same orchestration. After the exit of the aria's soloist, those left on the stage would continue in secco recitative, perhaps joined by others bearing dramatic news. Other arias would follow until everyone had sung an aria and made an exit. Oh, by the way, I would tell you that servants could leave without being granted an aria. Then there was a change of scene, and the procedure would be resumed. Duets, trios, quartets, and other ensembles were very, very rare, except in the final number, labeled coro, which means chorus, when, there being no real chorus, all the principal singers would line up and sing a bright, brisk, concluding ensemble, usually in what we call block harmony, clunk, 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 everyone singing together with the same rhythms. When we put all of this together, the predictable sequence of recitative and aria, the fact that most of these plots are based either on ancient history or on mythological people, when we consider the magnificent stage sets and the almost invariably serious content of these operas, we realize that what Metastasio has done is formularize and standardize a whole school of opera, which today we call Italian opera seria, serious opera. So when we talk about seria, or this so-called serious opera, we're talking about the Metastasian ideal, the ideal of recitative followed by aria, on and on and on, plots based on mythological or ancient history that deal with serious, if not extremely overblown, emotional content. Now, as a result of this formulaic and predictable alternation of recitative and aria, we get in Metastasio's libretti a subsequent alternation of, if it's recitative and aria, we're getting an alternation of words and music, of movement in real time, and of repose in stop time. Back and forth. Something happens, we stop and contemplate it. Something happens, we stop and contemplate it. Endlessly repeated patterns of tension and release. Recitatives building emotional tension, which finds outlet in the arias. I love the way Willie Fleming put it in his book, Opera. The recitative loads the gun, and the aria fires it. And that's exactly what happens. Now, clearly, these arias become the central musical events in these Metastasian reform operas. And these arias themselves become as standardized and as formularized as the libretti in which they are contained. John Brown, in his Letters on the Italian Opera, which was published in London in 1791, mentions five traditional aria types. That is, the arias become standardized and we have certain types. So let me quote John Brown's book from 1791. Type 1, the aria cantabile. Cantabile means singing. By preeminence so called as if it alone were song. It gives the singer an opportunity of displaying at once and in the highest degree all his powers. The proper subject for this air are sentiments of tenderness. Aria type 2, the aria di portamento, chiefly composed of long notes, such as the singer can dwell on. Oh, by the way, I'm just going to put an aside in here. Singers love long notes. Singers have spent their life developing their voice and learning to achieve tone. And you've got to give singers some big, fat, long notes so that they can take a deep breath and show you this wonderful breath and tone control. If you don't, they'll be angry with you. And frankly, you don't want singers angry at you. They say illogical things, but we'll get to the nature of singers in a few minutes. In any case, back to aria di portamento. Chiefly composed of long notes, such as the singer can dwell on, and have thereby an opportunity of more effectually displaying the beauties and calling forth the powers of their voices. The subject proper to this air are sentiments of dignity. Type 3, the aria di mezza carattere, of medium character, carattere, a species of air which, though expressive neither of the dignity of the aria deportamento nor the pathos of the aria cantabile, is, however, serious and pleasing. Type 4, the aria parlante, the speaking air, in which is that which admits neither long notes nor ornaments of execution. The rapidity of motion of this type of aria is proportioned to the violence of the passion which is being expressed by it. This species of aria goes sometimes by the name aria di nota e parola, and likewise aria agitata. Look, as I proceed, because I'm going to read you the last one, darn it, we have one more to do and we'll do it. We should be becoming aware that the act of writing an opera is not some inspirational act where the composer sits down and looks at the libretto and just sees how they feel. Oh, no, no, no. The act of composition is much closer to what an architect does when designing a building. You sit down, you decide what the scope is going to be, what the size of the lot is, what kind of building it's going to be, because form and function must be married. And then based on your budget and all of the realities you face, you design something that fits the needs of the client. That's exactly how composers work, especially opera composers who have to turn out a tremendous amount of material very quickly. Working with the librettist says, you know, I think it's time for something that really shows some real deep pathos. Let's do an aria cantabile. Or the composer looks at a libretto and says, there's lots of words here. Oh, this is going to be one of those patter type arias, or what we here call an aria parlante. But first you go through the libretto labeling everything and saying it will be this type or that type, and this is what I'm going to write here, and this is what I'm going to write there. This is a very logical and very workperson-like approach to the act of musical composition. It's not some random act of inspiration. If it was, no one would ever get anything on paper. The act of inspiration can only come after you've decided what your parameters are, what your restrictions are, and then you can afford to be inspired. But we should understand that these aria types were givens, were understoods, and when a contemporary listened to an opera, they would immediately say, oh, that's one of those, or, that's one of those. Our fifth aria type, at least according to Mr. Brown, the aria di bravura, aria di agilità, is that which is composed chiefly, indeed, too often, merely to indulge the singer in the display of certain powers of execution. Yes, bravura means virtuosity. Particularly extraordinary agility or compass of voice. Unquote, and this is just one of many extant aria classifications. There are many other tracts, many other letters, many other writings that classify other aria types dependent on the writer. Now, Metastasio had a lot to do with the creation of a structural formula for the arias themselves, and this is very important. So let me repeat. Metastasio had much to do with the creation of a structural formula for the arias themselves. And this is the so-called aria da capo, or da capo aria. Let me explain. A da capo aria is one in which we have one strophe or one phrase, and we'll call that A. And A is sung pretty straight, I mean bing, bang, bong. Then typically in a da capo aria, we have another strophe, another phrase, and that is given new music, different music, contrasting music. So we'll call it B. Now, having sung the contrasting phrase, we return to the original. We go back to the cap, back to the top. That's called a da capo. And we sing the original phrase again, A. But now the singer is given license, as is the composer. We don't want to repeat ourselves exactly. Isn't it tiresome when we're talking to someone and we realize we told this person the exact same story yesterday? It's an embarrassing moment when that realization strikes. So we suddenly add a flourish. We try to make a change. We try to alter it a little bit so that this person does not think we are an early Alzheimer's victim. In any case, the same thing might be true here in the aria da capo. When we return to the da capo, the composer will embellish, and the performer is expected to further embellish the notes of the da capo so that it sounds like a return, but it also sounds like a development at the same time. And more than anyone else, it is Metastasio who is responsible for creating this da capo procedure by the way he wrote his arias in his libretti, because this is how he structured them, as A, B, A's. As an example of a da capo aria, we're going to listen to one by Alessandro Scarlatti. This is not Domenico Scarlatti. This is Alessandro Scarlatti, who lived from 1660 to 1725. And this is an opera called La Griselda, and it dates from 1721. And it's an aria named Mi Rivedi, which means You See Me Again. Now, let me give you a little background on this story, and we'll dive in. Griselda has been the queen of Sicily for 15 years, but she's just been repudiated, rather unceremoniously kicked out by the king, Gualtiero. We can imagine he is now in search of that perfect trophy queen. So poor Griselda must return home to her humble origins. And this aria reflects her mixed feelings. On one hand, she's very sorrowful and very hurt and very upset at having been dumped and so disdained. And that will be heard in the A sections, A and then the da capo, what we call A prime. And these sections will be in C minor, a relatively dark sounding key, which is meant to resonate with the relatively dark emotions portrayed therein. However, she's also happy to be back home and happy to be away from the intrigues and the bull that characterize the court. And so the B section will be much brighter sounding music in E flat major. Please let us read the text. A. You see me again, O shady forest, but no longer queen and bride, unfortunate, disdained, a shepherdess. B. Yet there is my homeland's mountain, and here is still the friendly fountain. There is the meadow, and this is the river, and only I am not the same. Then back to the top, the da capo. The same words, but slightly different music. You see me again, O shady forest, but no longer queen and bride, unfortunate, disdained, a shepherdess. The libretto is by Apostolo Zeno. Zeno was one of those three poets I talked about before who were so active in creating the reform movement in early 18th century opera. Please let us listen to this piece, and I will point out these phrases as we hear them. First, of course, will be A, but I will point out B, and then the da capo, A prime. B.
Sorry.
Mr. Capo. Now, unfortunately, the overwhelming emphasis on arias in these Metastasian opera serie, and serie would be the plural of seria, and the stiff, unyielding formula of these arias, which are almost invariably in this aria da capo form, led to tremendous abuses on the parts of the singers. And again, I have to remind you that the virtuoso singer was to the 18th century what the solo pianist was to the 19th century, what the conductor and the movie star and the professional athlete are to the 20th century, that is, the transcendent media hero. Singers arbitrarily demanded changes in their parts. They demanded substitutions of arias, despite the fact that the substituted aria might have nothing to do with the dramatic content of that particular opera. They added embellishments and cadenzas that went far beyond good taste. They went far beyond the bad taste, if you want to know the truth, to become mere vocal display. Yes, please think about it. Sadly, Metastasio had the opposite effect he wanted to have. If you create a dramatic formula, after a couple of years, everyone's going to know what's going to happen in a story. And if all the arias have the same form, there's no real surprise in the arias either. So where is their dramatic interest? Where will there be danger and the unknown? Only in how the singers sing the arias, and the singers knew they were powerful, and their demands for ever more notes or for substituting arias were a reflection of their growing power within this Metastasian reform. The principle of absolute dominance of the aria entailed the absolute dominance of the singer in performance. And in their submission to this, audiences, composers, and poets allowed excesses on the parts of singers which would never have been endured in another age. Only rarely was even an autocrat like Handel, who had the incidental advantage of being both composer and manager in one person. Only rarely was even Handel able to control his singers, and only then by an extraordinary combination of tact, patience, humor, force, and the constant threat of physical violence. Handel was a big man, and he was not unknown to actually hang a singer out the window, which, by the way, apparently was a form of execution in medieval Germany, to simply drop someone out of the upper level of a house. Yes, indeed, Metastasio might insist all he pleased that poetry should be the dictator of opera, and he complained about the mutilation of his dramas, and now I quote Metastasio, by those ignorant and vain vocal heroes and heroines who, having substituted the imitation of flutes and nightingales to human affections, render the Italian stage a national disgrace, unquote. But of course, Metastasio was powerless to alter a situation that he with his own works, had so mightily helped to create. Thus, Metastasio continues to rail. The singers of the present times wholly forget that their business is to imitate the speech of man with numbers and harmony. On the contrary, they believe themselves more perfect in proportion as their performance is remote from human nature. When they have played their symphony with the throat, they believe they have fulfilled all the duties to their art. Hence, the audience keep their hearts in perfect tranquility and expect the performers merely to tickle their ears, unquote. Indeed, the technique of singing would seem to have reached heights in the 18th century that have never since been equaled. In the nature of things, it's difficult for us really to understand or to know what the singers of the era were singing, because the singer's greatest display of virtuosity was improvised. And, of course, it was impossible to record these because there was no recording medium, and very few of these improvisations were written down. So we really don't know exactly what Metastasio is talking about. In general, however, it could be said that there were two related practices that the singers of this era, of this second phase of the dark golden age of opera, indulged in. One thing they indulged in is called coloratura, and that is embellishing a given melodic line and making it very, very, very notey and highly ornamental, coloratura. The other practice they indulged in were improvising passages at the very conclusion of an aria. These passages would be called cadenzas, and let me quickly explain what a cadenza is. The Italian word for this is cadenza. The English word for that is cadence. A cadence is a musical punctuation mark. And that, of course, is what we would call a final cadence or a closed cadence, because we hear in its solidity a sense of closure. If that was a punctuation mark, it would be a period. So what singers would do is between the third to last and second to last chord, they would ask the orchestra to shut up, and I'm just going to do something. Warble, 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 warble. Sing, 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 sing. Plumb heights and depths of virtuosity and self-indulgence. End with a trill. And then properly resolve. These solos taken at the cadence came to be known by the name of cadence or cadenza. So these are the two brands of embellishment singers most often indulged in: coloratura, that is ornamenting a pre-existing melodic line, or stretching out the ending of a piece, sometimes painfully so, in what we call a cadenza. Now, I would tell you that the greatest vocal abuses were promulgated by the castrati. That's plural for castrato. Music historian Charles Burney traveled through Italy in the early 1770s. I inquired throughout Italy at what plays boys were chiefly qualified for singing by castration, but could get no certain intelligence. I was told at Milan that they only did this at Venice. At Venice, I was told they only did it at Bologna. But at Bologna, the fact was denied, and I was referred to Florence. From Florence to Rome, and from Rome, I was sent to Naples. The operation is most certainly against the law in all these places, as well as against nature. And all the Italians are so much ashamed of it that in every province they transfer it to some other. So none of the Italian cities want to own up to the fact that they use castrated boys, who of course grow into castrated men, who have voices very different from any other Homo sapien. Denials notwithstanding, Burney heard that there were gelding parlors across Italy bearing this sign: Chi si castrono ragazzi? Here are boys castrated. One wonders what sort of neon icon one would hang outside of that particular shop. According to Grout, there are many references to the presence of eunuchs among the singers of Italian and German chapels. during the 16th century. That would be during the 1500s. They are found at Florence in 1534, in the papal chapel at Rome in 1562. By the end of the 17th century, they were a usual feature in Italian churches, despite periodic pronouncements by the popes against the custom. They came into opera first in Monteverdi's Orfeo. 17th century Italian operas made use of them to almost the total exclusion of women. Castrato singers flourished, especially during the period from 1650 to 1750, both male and female roles in the opera being entrusted to them. Their popularity began to decline in the latter part of the 18th century, and the last Italian opera castrato, that is, someone who was surgically snipped, died in 1861. Their extraordinary vogue was due in part to the shortage of women singers after the first 2 years of the 17th century, coupled with the fact that for a long time, and this was true especially in Rome, women were forbidden to appear on the public stage. Even where women did take part in opera, for example in France, where there were no castrati singing, women in opera were generally regarded as morally outside the pale of respectable society. But the castrati held their own even in the 18th century when there was no dearth of really good female singers. The reasons are clear, by reason of the sheer superiority of their art. These castrated boys would have been educated in the conservatories of Italy from the moment after the castration at the age of 7 or 8 years old, 10, 12 hours a day for 10 or 15 years. They developed the most unheard of techniques in the history of vocal singing. Their voices, known as the voci bianchi, or the white voices, were more powerful, more flexible, if less sweet and expressive than those of women. And this vocal quality in the castrati often remained unhindered for more than 40 years. And that's amazing, because other voices break down, my friends. So great were the rewards of a successful career that even the slightest sign of a promising voice was often sufficient to induce hopeful parents to offer up their son for emasculation. Now, here's the rub, and boy, is it ever a rub. Even though the operation would obviously have to be done before puberty, these castrated boys would indeed have a voice change. All voices break at some point or another. They didn't keep a child's voice. So it wasn't until puberty was reached and passed that one could really know what kind of voice this poor male would end up with. And in 99 out of 100 cases, the voice was not suitable for singing. The inevitable result was, as Charles Burney, again an eyewitness, tells us, that in every great town in Italy could be found numbers of, quote, these pathetic creatures without any voice at all, or at least without one sufficient to compensate for such a loss. Yes, indeed. Now, of all of the Italian castrati, the most renowned was Carlo Broschi, who lived from 1705 to 1782. His stage name was Farinelli. Farinelli. He had a legendary career across Europe. He was brilliantly successful as a singer in virtually every country, the friend of princes and emperors, and for 24 years, the confidant of two successive Spanish kings and virtually prime minister of Spain. The hero of popular tales, my goodness, he was even the subject of an opera himself. He was a figure in the public imagination of the 18th century, comparable to Liszt or Paganini in the 19th century, or Marilyn Monroe, or Muhammad Ali, or Frank Sinatra, or Elvis Presley here in the 20th century. I've got a wonderful anecdote to tell you. Some castrati were known for their power, others for their brilliance. And I would point out, we're going to listen after the lecture break to a modern singer trying to sound like what a castrato might have sounded like. And you'll hear right away that a male soprano doesn't sound like a female soprano. It's a very different voice. It's high, but it's got a body to it that's not the same sort of body that a woman would sing with. There's a little more depth, and there's much more power. Still a male voice. Some castrati were known for their power, others for their brilliance. Gasparo Pacchierotti was known for his heart-rending expressivity. In Rome, performing Artaxerxes by Bertoni, Pacchierotti came to his climactic line, "Eppur sono innocente," yet I am innocent. This line is followed by an orchestral exclamation. Pacchiarotti sang the line with all of the pathos, power, and expressivity he could muster, and then he waited for the orchestral explosion. Nothing. Niente. He turned in panic to the concertmaster, the first violinist, and said, "What is happening?" And, of course, the reply, "We are all crying." I think that's sweet. Hey, if the singer can touch the orchestra, the singer can touch anybody. Look, tears notwithstanding, the castrati demanded ever more virtuosic and athletic arias with which to stun their audience and silence their many critics. Whether these arias had anything to do with the storyline of the opera in which they occur is often, sadly, immaterial. Now, I suppose, for human reasons, we should be glad that we can't really know what these male sopranos sounded like, because it would imply that we are still doing this, and we are not, obviously. However, there are some modern male singers who sing in their falsetto range, as Groucho Marx would say, not to be confused with a falsetto teeth. Anyway, there are some modern singers that sing in their falsetto range and have attempted to recreate both the sound and the virtuosic display of the castrati. Now, we're going to listen to just such a singer singing an aria entitled "We Are Like Ships on the Silver Waves" from Antonio Vivaldi's opera L'Olimpiada of 1734. So what we have, typical of the Italian opera of this era, is a da capo aria preceded by a brief recitative. Please, before we take our break, let's at least read through the text and talk about its nature, and then after break we will listen to the aria itself. By the way, this text was written by Pietro Metastasio. Recitative. "Of all the many follies of which the world is full, who can deny that the greatest folly is anyone that is in love?" And then the aria. Phrase A. "We are like ships on the silver waves, drifting out of control. Like capricious winds are our affections. Every pleasure is a rock, the whole of life a sea." B. "Like a steersman, reason keeps good watch over us. But then, on the swell of pride, we let ourselves be carried away." Da capo. "We are like ships on the silver waves, drifting out of control. Like capricious winds are our affections. Every pleasure is a rock, the whole of life a sea." Now, I've got to point out a couple of things right now. This aria is of a type. It is of the tempest type, a standard storm type aria in which the music illustrates the storm being sung about. For example, we have these endless roulades in the voice part. These roulades are meant to imitate the waves of the sea as they rise and the fall, and the blowing of the wind of the storm. And of course, nature here becomes a metaphor for human passions unleashed by love. I would also point out that this aria has been written for a tremendous vocal range. The lowest note in this aria is the A below middle C. The highest note in this aria is a C over two octaves higher. To make most male voices do that, you have to do terrible things to them. But, of course, this would be written for a castrato. In fact, specifically, it was written for Marianino Niccolini, who had this tremendous vocal range and, of course, who had the technical know-how to sing this aria. So, I think we should all be primed and ready. Let us take our lecture break here, and when we return, we will listen to Antonio Vivaldi's L'Olimpiada, the aria Siam Navi Alonde Algenti, as an example of the great art of the castrato. Thank you.